glimpse into a dark episode of history at the Pianese Livestock Barn. Nikkei National Museum is located in Burnaby and entry is by donation. Save the date for Pivots and Spins, Access Gallery's annual auction fundraiser on November 18th at 7 p.m. Promising to be Access's most exciting auction yet, Pivots and Spins features spectacular work generously donated by over 50 local and international artists, including Eli Bornowski, Daria Ake, Cindy Machizuki, Kathleen Ritter, and Sandra Semchuk. Complete with handcrafted cocktails, organic BC wines from Summerhill Pyramid Winery, Pilsner from Steam Whistle Brewery, works expertly framed by Fine Art Framing, and music organized by CITR 101.9 FM. Check out www.accessauction.tumblr.com for more details about contributing artists, the silent auction, and live auction works.
Sometimes it feels like the only thing
you can count on in life is the fact that Mint Records will always have a Christmas party and always have it ridiculously early. This year, join Woolworm, Needles & Pins, Jay Arner, Supermoon, Kelarisa, and Dumb at the Astoria on December 2nd for music, presents, and Christmas fun.
Dave Radio, Fridays at noon on CITR.
Wow, wow, Dave, you're so sway. Oh, Dave, I like your shave.
Hello, Radio Land. This is Radio Dave with Dave Radio on the radio there for you. It is Friday, the 2nd of November, 2017, and today we're going to do a special program. This week and next, we're going to get ready for Remembrance Day by doing a special two-hour feature that we produced originally about 2 years ago. It's called At Home and Overseas. It's an oral history of Canada during the Second World War. It's based on a book by Barry Broadfoot called Six War Years. And we collected a group of some of Vancouver's best actors, voice artists, performers, readers to tell the stories for you. You'll get a full listing of the voices at the end of the show, but you'll probably recognize a few of them. Some are familiar to the theater community. They're people you've seen on stage, people you've seen on TV, all kinds of great folks. So we're really pleased that they participated. We're really pleased to be able to present it for you now.
At Home and Overseas, a dramatization of the book Six War Years, 1939 to 1945, by Barry Broadfoot. Adapted for radio by Jason Logan and produced with the kind permission of the Broadfoot Estate. In the early 1970s, Vancouver journalist Barry Broadfoot gathered ordinary Canadian men and women to relate their first-hand experiences in the global conflict against fascism known as the Second World War. Broadfoot invited scores of veterans and others who supported their country as civilian war workers and family members to give their subjective impression of a period when Canada became a major combatant and eventually a member of the United Nations, strongly motivated to preserve world peace. These eyewitness accounts expose the tragic cost of war and retell the personal stories, filled with laughter and tears, of those who fought the battles, raised the children, and built the framework for peace. We present it to you with the wish that we may someday achieve a lasting peace for all humanity.
Yeah, I'm sure there were battles where men actually used the bayonet on each other, but sorry, I never heard of one. Can't even imagine. No thanks. I know what a bayonet can do, though. We were taking training in Shiloh, and on this obstacle course, there was a fence. It wasn't too high, I'd say 5 feet, perhaps. And this chap missed, or slipped, or made a miscalculation, and instead of landing on his feet, he fell to his knees. And his bayonet went into his belly. For a minute, we didn't know what was wrong with him. But when we started looking, yeah, he punctured himself. It was just a tiny little hole about the size of a pencil and a bit blue around the edges. By the time the ambulance came and took him back to the camp hospital, he was dead. I can't even remember ever being so shocked. Because this guy said he wasn't hurt and wanted to finish the course with us. The medical orderly at the hospital said the doctor told him the bayonet went only in about an inch and a half into that soft part of the belly. But he was dead in maybe 5 minutes. 10 at most.
This was in Normandy in the first Canadian field hospital setup. The casualties just came in batches. A lot of it was mortar and rifle wounds, and most would be brought in on stretchers. I was a Red Cross Corps worker, so my job wasn't actually in surgery or a real nurse's job in the field. But we had to do all we could to help. There were so many casualties that as soon as one spot was empty, or 10 or 20 spaces, there were others to fill them. That's why we tried to get them out by air or by ship from the coast within 2 days so they could be taken to England for special treatment. Some men were cheery, asking for a cigarette, joking. Some were in shock through loss of blood and just torn up bodies, and some would just want to touch you, touch the hand of a Canadian girl, and some of these were the ones who were dying. You got to know. They had this look about them, a whiteness, a look in their eyes. Some would die while you sat beside them. One did once, a young boy from Ontario, and he died as I was reading the last letter he got from his mother. He asked me to do it. He let out this kind of sigh, and his head fell down a bit, and then lifted up a bit, and then fell down again, and I knew he was gone. He had a lot of steel in his chest. I suppose he never had much of a chance. It was a time when you could work 12 hours a day and another 4 if you wanted to, and you'd crawl into the tent just dead. The bombing didn't bother us, the shelling. Sometimes it sounded like thunder rolling across the lake, just like at home at the cottage, hour after hour, and it got to be a part of you. If it was on, you didn't actually hear it, but when it stopped, you did. In air raids, it was us against them. We'd see Spitfires and American planes go dashing over. But mostly it was work. The usual things to keep them happy. We'd pass out tea with lots of sugar and newspapers like the Maple Leaf if we had any. Most or all of them spent less than 48 hours with us, so we never got to know them too well, and besides, not too many of them felt like talking. The first night you'd hear them talking to each other, sort of a low muttering, and I often wondered what they would be talking about. Then there were times when we'd help the nurses and the doctors. Say 25 men would come in at once. I nearly fainted the first time I cut off a uniform and saw a terrible wound. Just terrible. I hope he lived. Those doctors, those English nurses, everybody was just super, marvelous. Through all that carnage. That's what it was. Carnage. What a waste. I remember seeing a flash, a shoulder patch, on one jacket lying across the foot of the bed, and I knew that flash because it was the regiment which came from my hometown. I mean, about 4 or 5 small cities and towns had furnished men for it, and I had to look at that face. And he was unconscious, and it was Billy from back home, and I nearly dropped what I was carrying. I'd gone on skating parties with him, hay rides. I think I had a crush on him once. I don't think I ever knew what war and battle was until then.
While I was in a rest area in Italy, volunteers were requested for the 48th Highlanders, and I volunteered for that. I joined the 48th, and while moving out of the lines, I was concussed, and I got ruptured eardrums. So there I was in the 15th Canadian General Hospital. I'd also contracted malaria and yellow jaundice while I was being evacuated from the lines, and I was very sick for a long time, believe it. And one day, my brother Jim, who's with the Irish Regiment of Canada, comes to see me. He's my twin brother, you see, and we laughed and cried, and we were happy to see each other, and we made arrangements to get passes to go to Rome together. I got a 7-day pass, and Jim had a 14-day pass. And in Rome, we spent all our money and were AWOL for a few days, so we finally decided to go back to our units. We went, we had a shower, and I got talking about going back, and Jim said he figured that his luck has run out. He said that the last two men, the number twos with him on the Bren gun, had been killed, and he was pretty shook up when he talked about it. So I told him that I had a pretty good rest while I was in hospital and was being repatriated, so I would take his place in the lines and he would take my place and go home. So we traded pay books and battle dress, and he went to Gralino to be shipped back to England, where I was supposed to go, you see, and I went up to the lines to his unit, which was the Irish. It took me 8 days to go the 500 miles where the unit was. I knew a few boys in the Irish, and I'd been with them before. When I got there, I had more trouble with my ears, and I had to go to the MO, and when I was there, he wanted to check my wounds that I had gotten in Normandy. I had to tell him that I didn't have any wound in my hand. The doctor was quite mad, and I got stripped for a complete medical, and that convinced them that I wasn't the guy that my papers said I was. And he gave me a blast and sent me to the commanding officer. The CO put me under arrest, and I was charged with being AWOL, desertion, and forgery. Now, in the meantime, my brother had been locked up as he had been sent to the dentist back at the hospital where he had to report as me. And the dentist fitted a partial plate they had made for me, and of course it wouldn't fit in his mouth. He didn't need a partial plate. So he had to tell them he wasn't the guy they thought he was, that he wasn't me. So he had the same charges as I did. They throwed the book at both of us. However, things did get straightened away, and they eventually dropped all the charges against us. My CO said that he'd read about such things like this, but he never dreamt it would happen to him. He said the incident would go down in the history of the Irish Regiment.
I declare, it hardly ever leaves my sight. I sling it on my back and I take it everywhere. It even comes to bed at night. It's been a real good pal to me, I must confess, and helped me out of many a mess. My sister had a lot of socks to mend, so she gave me a fat bouncing baby to tend. And when I felt it leaking at one end, well, I did what I could with me gas mask. I bought a farm because I like fresh air. At milking time I tried to do my share. And when I found the book it wasn't there, well, I did what I could with me gas mask. For years I've courted Annabella Price and always found her just as cold as ice. Until one night the lass forgot her ma's advice, then I did what I could with me gas mask.
I was posted to Edmonton, Air Force. Now, this is the time of the start of the Alaska Highway, and Yanks, for Christ's sakes, Yanks everywhere. Mary, my wife, and young Tommy are first. They come out, and we live in a hotel and on an Air Force sergeant's pay. You try it sometime. But we're looking for a house, see? We try everything. Little limericks into classified ads, real clever stuff. Funny, but not a nibble. I make friends in the Queen's Beer Parlor with a guy in the circulation room at the Bulletin so I can get the paper first, and Mary and I rush out there, and there's three in line already. This is the way it is. 1 month goes by, 2 months, another. Hell, it looks like a divorce could be coming up. And we love each other. But three in a hotel room, about 10 by 12, try it, my friend. Just try it. So we're trying this tip again from my pal in the paper circulation. And we can't afford cabs. So we take the rock and roll trolley out there. And well, same old story, third in line. We're coming home about 5 o'clock and I'm desperate. She's desperate. We're both desperate. And I say, Mary, old girl, when this car stops next, somebody's going to get on and walk up to me and say, would we like a suite? Big, nice and warm, good for kids, good for parties. I went on like that, just as a joke. And so the next stop, screech, clunk, clank, and somebody walks down the aisle. He's a guy I had worked with once, a nice guy. He's in the army, and he's got this big house in the west end of Edmonton, and the guy who's in the upstairs suite, he suddenly posted that day to Helangon, and his wife is going back east, and there's this suite. Harry, he says, it's yours if you want it. I think my wife started to cry. I'm not sure, but I know I was damn close to tears, too.
Grab your coat, get your hat, leave your worries on the doorstep. Just direct your feet to the sunny side of the street.
Can you remember? You're at your graduation, and there's the principal standing up there with the carnation in his buttonhole. And he's saying, the boys in the class of 42, Kelvin High School, Winnipeg, should rush out and sign up. But he's making all sorts of sounds like duty and responsibility and devotion to our cause and stuff like that. Everything except, take the king's shilling, boys, and tell him the girls to pass among us handing out white feathers. Not all of us were old enough to tear right down to Smith and Portage and sign up for the army. But in 6 months' time, most of us would be. The army wasn't it anyway. Most fellows would have tried for the Navy first, the safe service, and then the Air Force. Even safer as long as you could stay on the ground, but awfully glamorous if you did make air crew. So mid-September comes along, and there I am. And in an hour, I'm in, but good. If you were infantry, which I was, you went across town to the University of Manitoba, where they had a basic training camp. In my class, there were 18 guys, and they'd all got the pep talks. Serve your country. Your country needs you. And all that. But all through the weeks of training out there on the campus, I'd see these guys lounging around with girls on the grass, just enjoying themselves, spending their old man's money. Guys who had been my best friends, or so I thought. Hell, I guess they were. We're coming in from a 12-mile route march, soaking wet and breaking in new boots and cursing life back to our great-grandfather's time, and here would be a couple of guys I'd grown up with, dressed for tennis, walking across the campus to the courts. I found out later that of those 18, only 3 joined up. The rest went to college or university. Oh, you can see how this rankles. I'm not sure I'm mad because I'm missing out on the girls, the tennis, and living the good life, or if I'm cheesed off because I've been had, that I could have gone to university. I met this one guy out at the campus once. We stopped to talk, and I said, and I remember, when are you enlisting? To the point, get it? He said, never. If you don't have to, why do it? Something like that. Ever feel that somebody might call you yellow? I asked. Probably, but anybody who knows me knows I'm not. And he walked away. I had to admit that was true, that he wasn't yellow on the face of it. And then he called back, ever feel that somebody might call you a sucker?
Canadian manhood proudly marches side by side with the free nations of the world. Canadian manhood marches, and young Canadians talk the matter over.
Say, Joe. Hey, Joe, come here. Did you hear what Churchill said the other day?
No, I was out fishing that afternoon. I didn't get a chance to hear him.
Well, he was talking about Hitler. He was talking about the way the Nazis have got hold of most of Europe, see?
Doesn't sound much like news to me.
Wasn't meant to be news. He was just talking horse sense.
Well, okay, don't be so mysterious about it. What was he saying?
Oh, one of those simple things that you don't think much about unless some guy draws your attention to it. The thing that seemed to stick in my mind was just one phrase. One by one.
One by one?
Yeah.
Well, what does he mean by that?
Well, that's Hitler's plan. Keep every nation out of the war until you're ready. And then take them one at a time, see?
There's nothing very original about that. Everybody knows that's Hitler's game. Why,
Yeah. Wait a minute. Listen to this. If all the countries that Hitler has conquered had known then what we know now and had acted accordingly, he'd never have captured them.
Sure. So what?
Well, so it's time we did a little fact-facing, isn't it? Maybe it's time we get into the war.
But we're in it.
You haven't got my drift, fella. I mean, it's time you and me got into the war.
Do you mean join the army or something?
Yeah.
Maybe it is. I hadn't thought about it.
No, I hadn't either. But I guess it's time we realize that sooner or later, it's men who are going to win this war. Men as well as machines. What do you think?
Yeah, I guess you're right. I guess we better swing into line.
There's a lot of people done it, fella. And I guess a lot more will have to do it before we're through with this business.
Okay. Let's go to work tomorrow and see what's needed. Let's join the parade.
Wenn der Führer says, wie ist der Master Ace? Wie heil! Heil! Right in the Führer's face, not to love the Führer is a great disgrace, so wie heil! Heil! Right in the Führer's face. Wenn Herr Goebbels says, we own the world in space, wie heil! Heil! Right in Herr Goebbels' face, wenn Herr Göring says, they'll never bomb this place, wie heil! Heil! Right in Herr Göring's face. Are we not the Superman? Aryan Führer Superman.
Yeah, we are the Superman.
Super duper Superman.
Is this Nazi land so good? Would you leave it if you could?
Yeah, this Nazi land is good. We would leave it if we could.
We bring the world to order. Heil Hitler's world to order.
Everyone of foreign race will love the Führer's face when we bring to the world disorder.
When the Führer says he is the master race, we heil, heil, right in the Führer's face. Not to love the Führer is a great disgrace, so we heil, heil, right in the Führer's face.
There was this fellow from Kenora, and his name was Alan. I can't remember whether Alan was his first name or his last name, but it didn't matter. What mattered was he was the best damn soldier I've ever seen. And this was before he even got into the fighting. He was 25 or so and had worked for the railroad, and when we were going through Kenora on our way overseas, his wife was at the station. How she found out, I don't know, but he got word to her somehow. It was only a 5-minute stop, I think, and she had their 3 little girls with her, and they all clung close to each other, the 5 of them. And the rest of us sort of hung back and just looked away. A lot of fellows weren't feeling too happy. It was what you'd call a sad little scene. A lot different than saying goodbye in your house on the last day and then going back to camp. This was it, going overseas. This was when you got down to the nuts and bolts of it. Now, the train gave a hoot. You know, some blasts, and our officers were yelling at us to climb aboard, and we did. And Alan did. And he's crying. And suddenly a guy named Johnson climbs out. Now, this Johnson is a real bastard. Things I could tell you about him. Nothing meant anything to this guy, just a thoroughly bad egg. He runs up to Alan's wife, and he kneels down and kisses each of the little girls. You know, 4, 6, 8 years old. And then he kisses Mrs. Allen on the cheek and grabs the train as it starts moving out. And when he comes into the coach, he's crying too. Never forget it. He told us he'd spend his embarkation furlough with a hooker somewhere in Winnipeg, and I don't doubt for a minute he did. But I have a real strong, sneaking suspicion that somewhere he had a nice wife and little kids like Allen had. Funny about guys in the Army. You can never tell about them.
Hello?
Good morning, Mrs. Smith. I'm calling on behalf of the local salvage committee. The country needs any old aluminum ware that you may have around the house.
Well, I'm not quite sure that I've got any. But if it's needed for the war, of course I'll have a look. Is it really needed?
Yes, it's needed badly.
Here is a call to every Canadian housewife. During the month of September, the National Salvage Campaign Office is conducting a campaign for the collection of aluminum scrap. Will you, we mean you, lady, sitting there listening to this program, will you help? Every ounce of aluminum not now in use is needed by your government for war purposes. Your scrap aluminum, leaky pots, a pan which is perhaps burnt, old shoe trees, broken cocktail shakers, broken parts of washing machines or vacuum cleaners. Your scrap aluminum can help to win the war.
It was like in every big city. There was one big building full of people turning out propaganda. I used to say to my husband, I wish we could read a happy story about the war, or one that had something other than knitting 10 pairs of socks for the Navy in one day, or a new way to make rhubarb edible, or a mom whose six sons weren't all in the RCAF. The newspapers, they were just propaganda sheets. My goodness, on the front pages, war, war, war. And inside, how to cook cheaper, how to do victory gardens, why we should have carpools, buy victory bonds, and tell your friends they were traitors if they didn't load up on them too. And how to teach children that all Germans were monsters, with poison dripping from their jaws. The family down the block were Germans, Schmidt, and as fine a family as you'd find. And our kids went to school with half a dozen Italian families and played on the same hockey teams and went to the same parties. You'd look at the front page, and there it was, war in the Pacific, Japs bombing women and children refugees, while all we bombed were military targets. We were the good ones. Now I'm saying these things, and nobody's going to come around and take me off to the pokey. Not now, but then, maybe. That's why people said they were Austrians when they were German. But you'd never read that in the papers. Only what the government wanted you to know. What they wanted to tell you. It was a farce. When Dieppe came along, and I had a son in it, although we didn't get ashore as he was in one of the boats that were in reserve, why, it must have been 2 weeks before we found out what was happening. That was a kind of propaganda, too. No news at all. The kind which was the worst was the casualty lists. And if they could have kept them out, I guess they would have. But they couldn't. I remember Dickie Johnson was missing in action. Bomber crew, you know? And we wondered why we hadn't seen his mother, a widow lady, for days and weeks. And then it came out in the Herald, and I went over right away. Right next door, but one, mind you. And there she was, nearly dead with grief. No, half mad with grief. Mess all over the place, and her cat dead from something, and she didn't care. There were all these mysterious shortages, and we weren't to ask why. Just do as you were told. Just buy bonds and don't ask for a decent pair of shoes or zippers. My God, zippers! What a crisis there! No zippers! Back to elastic. It was all war. War and how brave our boys were. And I don't care if they were brave. Did we have to have it shoved down our throats year after year? I surely think they sat back in Ottawa and Toronto and thought we were just a bunch of idiots from Halifax to Vancouver Island, and we could be told anything and we'd believe it. Yes, that's it. We could be brainwashed. I have a few old papers. The one where my son was wounded. I mean the one with his name on the casualty list. When my sister's son was killed on that Navy ship, the peace stories, and the D-Day landings. I saved those kind of papers as souvenirs. And if you want to see just how bad that propaganda was, you should read them. We could read the posters, listen to the radio, and we read the newspapers. And a war isn't ring around the rosy. It is serious, and many people are killed.
Exactly right to say that everything was rosy for anybody. It wasn't for me. Not in Edmonton, and this was 1941. My husband was dead, and I worked in a plant making uniforms. The owner may have been making a fortune, but it was all going into the cash drawer. I had a girl 16 and a boy 13, and I knew if I could get to Vancouver, where my brother was in war work, I'd be okay. We had really nothing to sell, and after shipping suitcases to Vancouver, we didn't have enough for fares. So my daughter said, Mom, we could hitchhike. This was late September or October, and what a sight we must have made. We got to Banff in car rides, but half a day or so stuck there, I knew we'd have to hitchhike on a train. So we waited until a freight train came through, and there was this open door. I boosted my daughter and son up into the car with a couple of sacks we had, and then I had to figure out how to get up, and I couldn't. And then the train started to move, and I couldn't let the kids go, and they couldn't jump, so I grabbed onto the ladder at the end of the car. Did I say it was cold? It was bitter cold, with a bit of snow, and I'm hanging onto the ladder with bare hands, this steel ladder, and I can't climb up, and I know I have to drop off soon. And then this brakeman is coming along the top of the train, and he hears the kids bawling, and he runs down to the caboose and yanks a whistle, and the train stops. And he and another man come running up, and they take the kids and me into the caboose, where it's warm, and feed us. And that journey is a long, long way. And it's cold, and it's snowing most of the way, and we just wouldn't have survived. At Kamloops, the brakeman passed us on to the next brakeman taking over. We got to Vancouver because that brakeman passed us on to another brakeman. Those three or four railroad men saved our lives. And that's as sure as I'm here with you.
I didn't want to go to war. Why should I join up? Get myself killed off by some German guy who didn't want to be in the war either and didn't know me like I didn't know him or vice versa? You get what I mean? Except for one thing. I'm Jewish. And while my old man didn't want me to go, to join up, like, you know, why don't I go to the University of Toronto, be a doctor or a lawyer or something, but keep out of the whole business. But my mother, she's a battleship, that woman. She wouldn't hear of it. Yes, he's going to go when his time comes, and when he gets to Jerusalem, he's going to the Western Wall, and he's going to take out his psalm book, and he's going to read the 83rd Psalm. Mom sort of had the war all twisted up in her mind, you know. She'd read the headlines about the British 8th Army fighting near Cairo, and she'd look at a map, and holy smokes, that's only 2 inches from Jerusalem. 2 inches on the map, like maybe 250 miles. One son of hers is going to pray at the wall, you bet your life. So, while the old man is against it, there's Mom practically pushing me out the door on my 18th birthday down to the recruiting station. "Join the army, my boy," she says, "and you'll get there faster. Look, look where they were on the front page of the Star last night, not that far from Jerusalem." It doesn't fit her thinking that the whole idea of the 8th Army is to get far away from Cairo over to the west, as far away from Jerusalem as it can. She was one woman with tunnel vision. I join up. So, a year in Canada, 4 months in England, then France, Germany, and home again. About 2.5 years. Home, and my folks meet me at Union Station. Brothers, sisters, brother-in-law, you know, their kids, cousins. Real big Jewish reunion right in the center of the station. God, when I think of it, Mom gets to me first. And I get hugs and kisses, and everybody is around. And finally she says, "Esther, did you use the book?" I ask, "What book?" "The Book of Psalms I gave you on your last leave." Then it hits me. The Western Wall, Jerusalem, the 122nd Psalm, the 83rd Psalm, standing up there with all those old men crying and weeping, the kind of Jew I just don't like. I tell her, "Mom, I didn't get to Jerusalem. I didn't get anywhere near it. Our army wasn't going that way. We turned right instead of turning left." That was the wrong thing to say, making fun of something like that. She stops me cold with that look in her eyes. And she's a little woman, but solid steel. And she says one word. She says, Schlepper. Just Schlepper. That's what I am. A Schlepper. For Mom, I don't fight the war for democracy in Canada. I fight it to go to Jerusalem so she can tell the neighborhood women, Hadassah, Mrs. Moser down the street, and all the rest about her son, Isser. The crazy thing is, later when she calmed down, I told her I was sorry that my war career hadn't worked out the way she wanted it, and she came up with a beautiful line. She said, Isser, he just didn't try hard enough.
Top of this little hill, and our ammunition and supplies came up on mules led by Moroccans at night, and as we were 3 miles from the jeep head, our one meal a day was liable to be pretty lukewarm by the time it got to us. Also, we had to scrounge our own water. We got it from a well down in the ravine below us. This well was in no man's land, so the peasants used it, and we did, and so did the Germans. It was funny, but it worked. And then, one day, we realized the well no longer was neutral. Jerry had taken it the night before, so we were in a pretty pickle. The next night, there was a big fight, and we couldn't get down, and the mules didn't come up. And have you ever seen men 2 days without water? I was the sergeant. We had no officers. They were all killed. So I announced to the guys I was going to go down to get water. This was in broad daylight, but we had to have water. So I took 2 jerry cans and the Tommy gun and started down. And the further I went, the more I started to get scared. And then I had a bright idea. Maybe the first bright idea I ever had. The Italians were still using the well. So why wouldn't I dress up as an Italian woman? You know, old and bent, gnarled, black dress, long black veil. So I crawled over to a house that had the hell pounded out of it. And sure enough, I found some clothes. It fitted me right to a T. The last 20 feet were the hardest, but I got there. Fill her up. And then suddenly it hit me. Italian peasant women carry their water on their heads. Seeing me strolling along carrying 2 cans, pssst, the end of me. See, Germans were all around. I couldn't see them, but they knew I was there. So I kind of kicked one jerry can aside, picked up the other one, put it on my head. And I don't have one of those donuts the women have to protect their heads, so I was going through the torches of the dam. But there I was, going up this steep path, one hand on hip, mincing along like an Italian tart, the other one keeping this can from falling off. And when I got to our lines, our guys yelled. Jeez, our guys got it! Cheering and yells and whoopee! And then we rationed out the water, and that night we got the well back. Nobody really said anything much about me getting the water, but that incident tells you a lot about Canadians. I think it does.
In the countries that have not suffered invasion, it's hard to realize what the coming of the Nazis would mean. In Winnipeg, they've just held an IF day. IF meaning invasion. The mayor is arrested. The flag of freedom is hauled down to be replaced by the crooked cross. The entire city is at once placed under martial law, and Nazi martial law at that. The freedom of the press, of course, is promptly abolished. Civilians everywhere are roughly handled, kicked out of restaurants, for instance, as all food is commandeered by the invaders. Religious freedom abolished. All places of worship immediately closed. Priests and ministers seized and probably murdered. The new order has no place for religion except when Hitler calls upon the deity for help. Schools would be taken over, for the children of the conquered people are taught quite a different culture. Everything would be Nazified as Hitler has tried to Nazify Europe. All property looted and paid for, perhaps, with worthless paper promises. The leaders and many others beside marched to a concentration camp to be starved, ill-treated, and tortured. All this and much more would happen here if...
It was like kids playing cowboys and Indians, this IF day.
They had it in Winnipeg in 42. I remember there was snow on the ground. The idea of the if part was, what if German troops occupied Winnipeg? Then what kind of life would we lead? About 3,000 troops took part, and about half, I think, were dressed up like Nazis, and the rest were in Canadian uniform. I think the German duds came from Hollywood, from one of those war movies. That was one part of the if. The other part was that this here invasion of Winnipeg would go on until a victory bond drive was subscribed. All paid up. V-bond days were big then. Everybody was supposed to buy, and if he didn't, then he was a traitor. I spent any money that would have gone on bonds for booze. I had one kid in movie school, and that's just off Portage Avenue. You know, the main drag? And these guys dressed like monkeys came into his classroom and tore all the patriotic slogans off the walls, yelling and shaking their fists, carrying on like monkeys. Oh sure, the Canadian troops lost. The Germans were supposed to have a division in armored vehicles, and they zoomed up and down Portage Avenue for a while and burned some old books from the public library and captured the Manitoba cabinet and put them somewhere. Can you really imagine people in the middle 20th century giving a damn about such shenanigans? I remember there was a picture in the paper showing the German troops giving a hard time to the newspaper seller at Portage and Main for selling newspapers, I guess. They tore up his papers. They did some looting, too. Carrying some furniture out of a downtown hotel? I mean, what the hell? Why carry furniture out of a building into the snow? It was so dumb a plot that even a fool wouldn't believe the darn thing, and Winnipeg was laughing about it, laughing their heads off. How far was Germany? 6,000 miles, I guess. But maybe that didn't have anything to do with it. I can't remember if they got their war bond money, but I guess they did. They always seemed to. Even if they had to put the Prime Minister on the radio and get him to cry his eyes out for the people to give. That was IF Day. And it was a farce.
Nobody questioned anything. It was war, and everything the government did was right. Except, there was one friend of mine. Her family was communist or something like that. Her family used to question the war, how things were done, and I used to report them to the RCMP. And she was my friend. This is the way we lived. I can't remember too clearly, but I remember picking things up around her home, pamphlets, which I thought were absolutely terrible, and that the whole country was going to rack and ruin. Later on, I didn't think anything happened. That was the time when we were friends with the Russians, allies. But I did report them to the Mounties. It was crazy when you look back on it now, what we did.
Got to England with the first division, it was just about Christmas, and they put us in an old barracks in a place called Woking. That 1939 winter was one of the worst Britain had had in a long time, and the huts had no heating, and being Canadian, heating was one thing we were used to. We had to scrounge wood and coal, and we weren't very good at that because we were just recruits, so all in all, it was a pretty miserable winter. We were at the Inkerman barracks. The lights were still on in London. They were still selling bananas and oranges in the store, and we were having a great time. The air raid shelters were there, but not used yet. There was no sense of impending doom, but a lot of comradeship. The feeling was the British would fight for a few months, put these people down, and go back to the usual, you know, running the world. At Woking, we got our basic training. Shorter training. Well, we could pick up. They showed us the end of the rifle that the bullet came out of and gave us the red patches. You know, the famous red patches of the Canadian 1st Division. I was in the Service Corps by then. We didn't get much training in. But we were training with the 7th British Corps and the 51st Highland Division. The infantry was part of it. And so we just fumbled our way through the winter. I think it was late February. The 51st Highland Division went to France. And they were wiped out when the Germans started taking over. I want to say this. We didn't know what was happening. We knew the Germans were going like hell, but we didn't know anything more. Nobody did, I think. So they bundled us up, took us down to the coast and put us on a ship, and we disembarked at Brest. We had all the food supplies, the petrol supplies, all the ammo, and it was our job to get it up to the front. So there we were, with the Germans maybe only 100 miles ahead, and the whole of France had collapsed, and we were still going on our merry jaunt. I'll say. It was like you're at a football game when it's over and everyone just surges for the exits and pushes and shoves and nobody cares about anyone else. French troops, civilians, old men, women, kids, bicycles, baby carriages, cars pulled by horses or cows, wagons, push carts, all going down the road. Tens of thousands of them. And they didn't know where they were going, except they'd say the Germans were coming. They called them the Boche. But we didn't have any orders. We just sat there. This was the time of Dunkirk, and then they say to get the hell back to Brest. Get back any way you can. That's when we scattered. Every truck for itself. So my partner and I headed back, and I think the Germans were maybe only a few miles behind, and these refugees, it was tough going past them. Thousands, and they didn't know where they were going. Where were they going? What was there to go? It was lucky there was no strafing by the Germans where we were. It was chaos. There was no order that I could see, no regimental discipline, nothing, just one vast screw-up, and it lasted like that for some time, as I remember. Anybody could have conquered England if they just could have got ashore. Britain had nothing left to defend itself with. All our prime fighting forces, and when they got back after Dunkirk, it was just a great mass of men. No material, no guns, no ammunition, no organization, no nothing at all.
Vor dem großen Tor stand eine Laterne und steht sie noch davor. So wollen wir uns da wiedersehen. Bei der Laterne wollen wir stehen, wie einst die liebe Marlene, wie einst die liebe Marlene.
The Big Raid, they called it. I remember my sister sent me a clipping from some paper, a headline, and it was the day they released the news, and it said that Canadian troops were jubilant about the success of their invasion of France. Now that is pure and unadulterated bullshit. We got the shit kicked out of us. It was about 10 hours of unadulterated hell, from the moment the Germans saw us coming in our dinky little boats until we got off. We were trying to scale the cliffs the size of the Royal York Hotel, and the Germans had us crisscrossed six ways from Sunday, and it was... well, I guess you could call it a massacre. It sure wasn't our victory, or even a saw-off. It was a German victory all the way. Maybe if we'd had gunnery support from the Royal Navy before hitting the beaches, maybe that would be different. But in the end, it would not have made one sweet continental dam. We were just ducks in a shooting gallery. Look at the casualties. Worse per unit, I think, than any time else in the war. Whole companies wiped out and captured just like that. Zoop! In fact, the casualties were so bad they dribbled them out to the newspapers 100 or 200 at a time. And it was weeks before they said how many wounded, killed in action, died of wounds, missing, and of course captured. The Germans filled up a prison camp with our guys after that one. But I'll tell you one thing, and I think most people don't know this. Dieppe had one effect. It taught them swollen-assed generals something. Some genius in the British War Office likely said, "I say, old chap, how do we know the Germans are actually there? Might have a raid, you know? A jolly big one. See if they are there, what they've got, right?" And Churchill or somebody probably said, "Oh, jolly good thinking. Brothering hot and we'll send it to the Canadians. See if the beggars are as good as they say they are." Well, we were good. But not even King Kong and all his friends from the jungle and John Wayne could have done anything there. It was like telling you to go up to the main post office over on Front Street and start hitting one of those big pillars at the entrance with your fist, and keep hitting until you knock it down. All you get is blood and broken bones.
Dieppe, I think it was a shambles. But in retrospect, I think it had its merits too. I was involved with the I section, intelligence at that time, and I've always maintained that it was bad planning from our point of view. But the raid went on, for two reasons. One, this raid was done to encourage the Russians, and also to show the world, but especially the Canadian people, that their troops were at the ready and eager for battle. That's number one. But the aspect to which I was privy, and I've never seen anything written about this, was that on the 19th of August, the day of the Dieppe raid, the largest convoy up to that time to leave England would pass the mouth of the Channel. It was a 200-ship convoy to North Africa, loaded with troops and equipment to do the final roll-up of General Rommel's forces in Africa. Now, one thing is significant here. The Dieppe raid was to have been in mid-July. It had been scheduled for that time. There was no other reason to change the date to August, the day of the other sailing. So, in my opinion, the Dieppe raid had the effect of occupying the attention of the German Navy, the German Air Force, and, obviously, the land forces. It stopped them from interfering with the passage of that convoy until it was out of those dangerous waters and on to comparative safety. So, if you want to call Dieppe a sacrifice, then it was a sacrifice. But in retrospect, it was a worthwhile sacrifice in terms of helping to protect that huge convoy which was heading for North Africa.
To work summers for Canadian Press as a female copy boy, and after I graduated from the University of Manitoba, they sent me out to Calgary to the bureau there. They got me a train berth, and I spent all night reading the manual about how to operate the ticker tape machine, the news teletypewriter in the office. The morning the invasion came was my first day, and when the first flashes and bulletins about D-Day came through on the perforated tape, they couldn't send them from Winnipeg to Vancouver until the whole line was clear. Right across the country, on the inner city wires, they had to have my signal that the line was clear before they could go ahead with the invasion story. All I had to do was punch out C-A-L and then a few spaces and then C-L-R. That meant Calgary clear, and so the whole line would be open from Winnipeg to Victoria and the war could go on. In other words, three letters, a space, and three letters, and I punched it out, and my career as a bureau chief in a one-woman bureau had begun. But I was so excited or something that I must have punched something wrong, and the carriage return shot back, and the whole thing went wild with bells ringing and everything happening. I couldn't think. I was absolutely shattered. I knew it was the biggest story of the war, and there I was lousing up my end of it. I started to faint and hung out the window in this little room no bigger than a closet and tried to phone the phone company while I was hanging out the window and trying to get air. And on the wire service, everyone was signaling, "When are we going to get this war news in the West?" and stuff like that. Finally, Don Miller in the Edmonton Bureau figured out what was up and realized I was in a panic. Since he was connected on the same circuit with me, he just knocked out Calgary clear, and the war could begin again.
We went overseas in July of 42, I think. Just a bunch of Air Force guys in a troop ship loaded with Army guys. Anyway, on the dock, there was a few women, and they had baskets, and they were passing out apples, little bags of things like hard candy, razor blades, maybe an orange, knitted socks, all those kinds of things. They were just ladies of the town of Halifax, and somebody said they weren't really supposed to be there, but nobody actually turned them away. They'd say, "Good luck, soldier," or "Cheerio, airman," and one lady said to me, "Be sure to write your mother." I always remembered that because I wasn't much of a letter writer. Okay, it's 3 years later, November 1945, another troop ship homeward bound. We come off the gangplank, and there's ambulances for some of the guys who need them, but mostly it's just us, thinner, maybe a bit wiser. And I'll be damned if there isn't this same old lady, and she says as we pass by, she says as she hands me an orange and the Halifax paper, "Did you write your mother, son?" And I nearly dropped dead. I think, does she remember me? No, because I hear her say the same thing to a guy about two places behind me in line. And you know what? That old biddy must have been doing that job, rain or shine, passing out little goodies and asking the guys if they would please write to their mothers. One hell of an old gal. Year after year after year. Somebody should have pinned a medal on one of those old gals. Maybe someone did.
Boys in Europe thought they had a long flight if they had 7 or 8 hours, but for us, 14 hours was a pretty routine mission. We were flying Liberator bombers, American-made, and we would hit Rangoon, Siam, Malaya, Burma, and once we even did a raid dropping pamphlets on Singapore. There's not too much heavy anti-aircraft by then. The Japs were pretty well finished, but we used to blow up a few troop concentrations with fragmentation bombs. See, the Japanese pretty well had it. Gin and lime cordial was the big drink then. We'd fill up our flasks with booze, and on the long flights, we came back, we'd be smashed. Yeah, I think there was an agreement that either the pilot or the co-pilot would stay reasonably sober, get us down all right. Yeah, when you're 19, it was still a pretty exciting war.
Listening to At Home and Overseas, based on the book Six War Years by Barry Broadfoot, featuring the voices of Adam Abrams, Garth Barrier, Mary Black, Dave Campbell, Caitlin Docking, Bob Fraser, His Majesty King George VI, Lorne Green, Adam Henderson, Julia Henderson, Paul Herbert, Keenan Johnston, William Lyon Mackenzie King, Sebastian Kroon, Tarek Leslie, Jason Logan, Ashley O'Connell, Sean Harris Oliver, John Prowse, Nick Rinka, Maureen Rohde, Deborah Sears, Bronwyn Smith, Lara Rose Tansey, John Taylor, Tracy Vardew, Rebecca Walters, and Jessica Wright. Produced with the cooperation of the Estate of Barry Broadfoot, the Union of BC Performers, the Student Radio Society of UBC, CITR-FM. This program was adapted for radio by Jason Logan, produced by Dave Campbell, and directed by Jason Logan and Dave Campbell. This is Seth Little speaking.
Listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Spinning for millions of years, but eventually becoming just wind.